So welcome everybody. Hopefully you are here for IKEA 201, Introduction to Engineering Design. What I'm going to do, I'm going to send around today. This is a roster as of 10:30 this morning. So this is the official record of actually who's in the class. So if you want to be in this class and are not on this, you weren't officially in here at 10:30, so you want to check on that. There's a few blank lines. If you're not on this list, write your name in at the end on those lines. So I started over here. Make sure you get to see this before you take off today. Thank you. There's also a column, rightmost column. You should have received an email from me sometime last week, I think it was, talking about the kit you should buy instead of an expensive textbook. If you already purchased that kit, check it off on the sheet as well. Okay. We'll talk about it a little bit more in a second. Okay. So I'm going to give you a little bit of information about who I am and where I come from, just so maybe you'll trust me a little bit when I talk about these things. I'm originally from Southern Virginia, just south of Richmond, Virginia, about 20 miles. So the town I grew up in is very much like if Lafayette was 20 miles from Baton Rouge kind of size, right? So Richmond is Baton Rouge sized. I grew up in a town a lot like Lafayette in terms of that. But they are kind of distinct areas. Went to a small school in Virginia called Hampton-Sydney College. It's actually the 10th oldest school in America. It was founded in 1775. When I was there, it was about 1,000 students only. So we have our College of Engineering is bigger than the undergrad college I went to. It's actually all male university, one of the few left in the country. Always wanted to be an engineer, so I ended up at this small liberal arts college in the middle of nowhere, Virginia. The closest town is called Farmville, which pretty accurately describes where it's at. So went there, actually ended up majoring in physics and math. No engineering in a school that size, typically, because I played baseball there. So that's kind of how I ended up going that route, with the plan of going to grad school always. So ended up starting all 4 years, had a pretty good time. Turned out to be the right decision, I think, so far. Maybe I'll change my mind, but so far it seemed okay. Went to grad school. Again, the plan, always go to grad school. Kind of lucked into going to a pretty good grad school. Had no idea what I was doing. Am the first person in my immediate family to go to college. So even undergrad was a bit of a mystery to us. And then trying to go to grad school was an even larger mystery. So kind of lucked into going. Applied to Georgia Tech because a friend of mine was. He didn't get in. I did. Although he came later. So he has my class of physics majors at Hampton-Sydney, of the 10 of us, there's 10 physics majors that graduated together, 6 of us have PhDs, and 5 of those in engineering. So it was a pretty good class. My advisor, Dr. William Singho, is pretty well known in the area of research we do. He was actually a national champion decathlete, so we kind of had that in common and are pretty good friends since I've graduated. So I finished my master's degree in 2004. My master's degree research was actually in suspension design, but suspension design for heavy machinery, not on-road cars. But the work is pretty similar to some that high-end sports utility vehicles, like Lexus has a similar system on their high-end sports utility vehicles now. So what we do is actually an active suspension control system. So we are changing the suspension parameters in real time based on current road conditions and driving conditions. All right, so quite often, for example, the Lexus system is really concerned with driver comfort. Right? It's a luxury vehicle, wants to be nice and comfortable, typically. You'll see some high-end kind of sport utility vehicles, if you will, try to maintain give you the balance between comfort and performance. It's kind of what we were aiming for a little bit, because our vehicles, we were looking at ones that have large payload variation. So a dump truck. Dump truck drives around much differently, behaves much differently full compared to empty. So we were looking at trying to mitigate some of those differences in terms of what the operator feels and what it takes to drive the thing around, which is really important if you're a new dump truck driver or not driving a dump truck very often. And it came in, actually, Dr. Singos, like me, was one of the first, I think the first in his family to go to college. His mom was a dump truck driver, so he had some personal interest in that as well. My PhD research finished 4 years later. Was actually in the control of cranes. So we do a lot of crane control, vibration control research. So the crane stuff, which you'll see some videos from now, is kind of an extension of vibration control. So time at Georgia Tech was great. Really like Atlanta. It's a cool city. I think underrated as a city. Following my time at Georgia Tech, went to Japan for a year, worked for Hirose-sensei, who is a really smart guy. He's one of those folks that is playing the game a different game than the rest of us, it feels like sometimes. So this is one robot from that lab there, I think illustrates some of the things we're going to talk about here. So if you have a robot that's walking on, trying to traverse rough terrain, quite often walking is the way to go. Right? So there's a reason we have legs and walk. However, you get to a hard surface, like an asphalt surface, what's a more efficient way to move? Roll, some kind of rolling thing, a bicycle, driving, maybe skating. So this robot is designed to be able to shift between walking and skating. Right? So we're able to look at the design trade-offs for each of those different scenarios, the customer requirements for each of those for efficient locomotion, and change the design of the robot in real time effectively to mitigate that compromise optimally. So I think it's a cool illustration of the customer requirements, the design constraints change once we know we're on a hard ground. And so our optimal design for that segment of our operating conditions, if you will, changes. Okay? So we have a design that changes. Professor Hirose is best known, however, for doing snake-type robots. So he actually just retired about 2 years ago, 3 years ago maybe. So public universities in Japan, you're forced to retire at 65. So he was forced into retirement. He's working for a company now that we do some research with. Still kind of cool to see someone that's been doing this for 40 years still really excited about what he's working on. So hopefully you all can have that in your lives. I want to have that in my life. So he was the first person to do a snake-type robot in the early 70s. It was his PhD work, kind of claim to fame. This is the latest iteration. The first version of this snake robot, he has a video of him from the 70s where it's kind of slithering along the ground. And then it pans over to him as a PhD student behind it with a cart the size of this table that has all the computing and stuff to actually control the thing. Right. So it's kind of impressive, you know, the progress since then, everything fits into this self-contained mechanism. Okay. What's pretty cool about this particular snake robot, which you can buy if you want, if you have $200,000 laying around, about what it would cost to get one made, is this is actually amphibious. So this guy will swim around. What's cool from a controls perspective from these 40 snake-type robots is the control of it in the water is actually not any different than it is on the ground. So the controller, the internal control of this is identical. Right? The other cool thing about these snake-type robots is really you need one supervisor that's kind of handling where do I want to go. And then each of the secondary links only needs to look at the link ahead of it and the link behind it to know what it should be doing. So if you have that one supervisor, you can chain together as many links as you need for a particular application. What would this kind of robot be good for? Search and rescue. That's right. So that's a big area. Some building collapses. You have some nuclear power plant incident in Japan, for example. You don't want to send people in, or you can't send people in. Okay. What's another application? Kind of along the same lines. What's that? Exploration. Somebody else said no. Pipes. So you have. You could do kind of pipe or there's a certain size pipe you need for a snake to work well. Really small pipes don't work so great, but that's another one. So inspection in small places as well. Kind of exploration, inspection in places where it's hard to get a traditional robot or hard for us to go, basically. So I think it's pretty cool work. We still do quite a bit of research with the company that came out of his lab. I mentioned my PhD research was crane control. So we'll use this kind of crane stuff, and you'll see a couple examples throughout the semester in terms of design and design considering human factors. So here's a crane at Georgia Tech. We have this kind of payload, kind of academic-type payload, because we can move the mass around and things like that, but representative of a general thing you'd want to pick up with a crane. And we have the crane hook to where whatever you're trying to pick up attaches, and then there's about 4 meters of cable up to the crane trolley. Okay. So, and then you see, it's actually Dr. Singo's over here. Most cranes today are controlled just by push buttons. So go forward, go left, go right, just different buttons for each direction. All right. What's the state of the art in crane control, you think, in most factories in America? What do you mean by stability? Well, how do we control those cranes? So most factories, we're not going to have to worry about wind so much because we're indoors. So I want to pick this thing up and move it as fast as I can to over there. Or move it and keep it from vibrating. What's the state of the art? What's that?
Like an automated system?
You would think so. Not yet. We're going to show you one in a second. So right now, well, let me show you the move and maybe you can guess from there. So this move, we're going to pick this up and move it over and move it into the board and set it down. It's a pretty standard example crane move. Pick something up and move it over there. Set it down. Okay. So the state of the art for this right now, and you see we can get quite a lot of vibration just from the simple move, right? The state of the art, let me pause. State of the art crane control. Any other ideas before I tell you the answer? Gyros? No. State of the art right now is kind of two components to it. One, move really, really slow so that you don't excite that vibration. Two, have four or five of your friends come over and hold on to whatever you're moving while you're moving it. You're done. Yeah. That is state of the art, state of practice in majority of factories around the world right now. Obviously, we want to do better than that, and we can. We have to convince these crane operators to adopt it. So this is our control system, my PhD research. 30 seconds after the video you just saw, we clicked it on. Same maximum speed, same maximum acceleration, exact same crane, exact same operator. We don't need five people coming over to help us. We don't need to slow down. And that's really thinking about the dynamics of that system. So you get later to control systems, vibrations. You guys are probably in dynamics right now, learning about dynamics. We model that thing as a pendulum, actually. All right? We can look at this system. So that kind of system you just saw, a really expert crane operator, someone that's driving a crane every day. And that's actually one of the big problems with these cranes is that people will use them once a week or something. I'm a factory worker. I do what I need to do. And then I'm using the crane to move the thing out of the way. So I don't use it enough to get really good at it. But there are people that are professional crane operators, and they get paid pretty well, usually. And professional crane operators can handle that system where the payload acts like a simple pendulum. Right? There's only one really vibration I need to worry about. It's kind of simple pendulum motion. This kind of payload rigging, so you see the same crane, but now we have this really long chain down to whatever we're trying to move. And this kind of vibration, we have not just that pendulum, we have a second mode of oscillation, which is kind of like a string vibration. So you'll see once this starts moving, there are in this vibration, you'll see the hook and the payload are not always moving in the same direction. Right? They move opposite of one another sometimes. And expert crane operators struggle with this case still. Okay. So you see, this crane we're trying to move from the square up top down into the circle on the ground and settle the payload in there. And the student's working really hard because there's $200 on the line for the fastest time doing this, which buys a lot of Bud Light. So every time we wipe through black is 1 minute cut out of this video. All right? So he's working really hard, pushing the buttons, trying to figure out what's going on, and not doing a good job of it. And a professional would do a little bit better, but not a whole lot in this case. Okay? We turn on our controller, and we don't have to wipe through black anymore, because it only takes him 11 seconds to do it now. A little bit better. And we've been able to achieve that by thinking a little bit more intelligently about what are we asking that crane to do. Looking at the constraints of our design problem and adapting our controller for that. And that's going to be a big part of this class. Is what constraints are there on our problem? What does our customer require of us? And then how do we address and design within those constraints? Okay. Another pretty cool system I've had the chance to work on is so the company that Professor Hirose help start. It's called Hibot in Japan. I was actually just over visiting them last week, or week before last, I guess. So they have this robot that actually sold the design. Hitachi purchased the design. So it's actually a high voltage power line inspection system. How do people inspect that those systems right now? Helicopter. That's how we do it in the U.S. So helicopter, U.S. and Canada, there's a guy in a helicopter that goes up and jumps off onto the lines, actually. So you don't inspect from the helicopter. The helicopter just takes the guy up, or lady. They jump onto the lines, actually, and then they walk along the lines and inspect them. And we do it on live lines. In Japan, they will actually shut off sections of lines for inspection. They're a little bit more safety conscious than we are. So this robot was designed to ride. So in place of a human, this robot rides on these high voltage power lines. Right? So we have all the, basically the battery and computing is down here on the bottom, and this counterweight we're able to move backwards and forwards. And that'll become pretty important pretty soon. We have these driving units, and we have a sensing unit on the front that we're able to move around as well. So we're not looking for breaks in the cable. That's obviously kind of too late. What we're looking for is corrosion. We're looking for single strands of the braided cable to start corroding. Right. So this is kind of how it works. The cool thing about this, it can operate on live lines. It can get around spacers. So here you see kind of the inspection surface. So that camera angle, so we can go around these spacers. And actually get around the towers too. So that's the big challenge for these kind of robots, is you don't have to go up every tower and put it around to the next set of cables. So we can get around these tower hangers, called suspender clamps, by basically shifting that mass backwards, all the battery and computing, and popping a wheelie. And we spin out the front wheels, go to the other side of the clamp, shift our center of mass forward, and do the same thing. You notice they just cut a slice of video out there. We'll talk about that in just a second. So overall, pretty cool system, I think. That slice of video that they cut out was basically when the system was in this kind of mode, right? And they called this the acrobatic mode of this system. Well, what's going to happen, you think, when I start driving that around in this kind of configuration? Yeah, he's got it. Yeah, so this thing will rock. Dynamically, this is just like a crane right now, right? I have something up top I'm driving, and then the center of mass is somewhere below there and can pivot around that point, right? So if I drive these pulleys now, this guy starts rocking. And if I don't drive them in the right way, I can get into big trouble. Or if I have wind blowing on the thing, I can get into big trouble. So where we helped them with was control of that rocking when in acrobatic mode. So here, you'll see it's actually, in this case, just simulation, but it is a full physics simulation, has all the dynamics included. You'll first see the rocking without our controller. So you shift that center of mass rearward. You'll see we start popping the wheelie pretty soon. And we're able to spin out that front, those front pulleys to get around the hangar. We start driving, you'll see we get some rocking. And then we stop, we actually get more rocking based on when we stop this system. So that's obviously not a good condition to be in. And you can actually get more than that depending on the configuration of the cables. So we take the same system, and actually same type of controller we use on the crane. Again, same simulation, use our controller. And now it looks almost fake because we have no vibration. But this is still that same full physics simulation. And again, we've just thought a little bit more intelligently about what the customer requirements, what the specs of this design were, what are the bounds on our process, and design within those bounds, right? Which is really what we're talking about most of this semester. Okay? We've also done some work on walking robots and have a thread of research working on that right now. Okay? So most walking robots to date walk around like they're doing the robot, right? You ask a little kid to walk like a robot, and they're going to walk really stiff and think, right? And there's a reason for that, because that's how most robots have moved around until relatively recently, right? And most robots, including walking robots, are made with really stiff links, right? The legs of a robot are really stiff. The arms are stiff and heavy, right? We've done that because we need to be able to control those, have those stiff links so we can control the thing. If I'm walking around, I want stiff legs and rigid legs so I know where my foot's going to be when I hit the ground, which is a requirement for me to not fall over. Okay? But as you've seen so far, we can do a pretty good job of controlling vibration now. So if we're able to control that vibration, maybe the leg can be a little bit flexible, right? So we've taken this robot, this kind of little insectoid type robot, and replaced those rigid links with these kind of flexible beams. So kind of mimicking what you might see for a athletic prosthetic, or an amputee, right? And what this allows us to do is a few things. One, we're able to store energy, right? This is a spring now, so it can store energy for us, right? And we can get to the robot moving closer to how we move around the environment, actually, right? We're using our muscles and tendons as springs in addition to motors or actuators, okay? So we're able to store energy from our footfall and use it in the next stride. Right? We're able to store energy before a jump and use it to jump higher. So looking at robots to do that. In addition, there's actually a pretty cool group that does research into cockroaches, actually, and looking at mimicking how cockroaches move around the world. And you look at a cockroach on really high-speed video, the lower part of its leg is actually pretty flexible. And that's really important for a cockroach because what that lets them do is not have to worry so much about where they're putting their feet. Right? They can just keep moving their legs, and the leg kind of flexes into place based on whatever terrain they're going over. Right. It's important for a cockroach because you don't have a lot of leftover brain power to be thinking about where your feet should be. Right? And that's the same for most robots, actually. Right? If we're able to not have to worry exactly where my foot's going to be, the robot can move its processing up a level and start thinking about, okay, now I can start thinking about doing real work at a higher level. So it becomes important. So our robot, just with these kind of prototype, initial version, not optimized really, you can see it walking here. This robot's 15% faster with these flexible legs than it is with the rigid legs. Right. So we're really excited about this research. We think it's really promising in terms of improving how we're able to move robots around the world. In a 3D printed way, doing it in an affordable way, right, which is a kind of secondary part of the project. Excuse me. I wanted to mention this project as well because we went to Hawaii, so this is the boat we have downstairs. Went to Hawaii last December 2016. We'll hopefully, pending me being able to get enough money to take people, going this December 2018. So this contest, Maritime Robot X Challenge, sponsored by AUVSI, which is Autonomous Vehicle Society, and co-sponsored by the Office of Naval Research. So every team there uses the same kind of catamaran hull, and then you add the propulsion. So we added motors, we added all the computing, communication, and sensing. And I mentioned this project because it's cool and a lot of fun, but then also the four guys that did it as their senior project were four guys from the very first semester of this course here at UL. It was offered here. Right? So they knew nothing about programming, they knew nothing about robotics, knew nothing about design when they came into this class, and then 2 years later, they designed and built the boat. So that's where all of you are going. Okay. Here's our boat in Hawaii, actually. So the tasks are not just navigation. The boat actually has to do some work. It has to find sunken objects within this kind of test area. It has to recognize buoys. So you see here kind of looking for buoys and trying to traverse between them. So it's a really complicated problem. And I think one of actually that's importance and interest regionally as well. So you can imagine monitoring Louisiana ports, or ports around the world, monitoring the Louisiana coast before and during and after storms. You can imagine running supplies to and from oil rigs in an autonomous way. Right? Running supplies, material, goods up and down the Mississippi, for example, maybe. So particularly of regional interest, pretty cool project. We actually updated quite a number of the systems after the contest already. We're excited about what we have going on. So here's a view of that same run from the onboard camera. This is actually part of one of their high school classes. They have to figure out, they have to learn how to bail themselves out. That's what they were saying. Forward a little bit. So here in this video, I show this one because you can see some of the other things. Like for example, you had to recognize one of those symbols and launch something into one side of that buoy based on what you saw. There's another part of the field where you had to avoid the black buoys and circle red ones counterclockwise or green ones clockwise, depending on what symbol you saw on this guy. Teams from all over the world came. We ended up in sixth place. University of Florida won. But there were teams, I think six or eight teams from the U.S., two teams from New Zealand, or two teams from Australia, not New Zealand, team from Japan, team from Korea, two teams from Singapore. So I think we did a good job getting there. Was an honor as well. So now that you maybe are convinced, you can trust me a little bit when I talk about design stuff. Here's our official course description. What does that really mean for us? Practically, is we're going to do a series of projects. This is a project-based class. We're going to build some robots this semester and hopefully learn something along the way when we're working through these projects. All right. We're going to use these robotic, and particularly the final robotic project, as a proxy for learning the design process. Okay. Lecture, you found us. This is where we're at. And then we have lab. The lab is set up into three sections, but we will stay together most of the time in here. Okay. There'll be a few things where later on in the semester we'll have some things going on, but most of our labs will be just right here. Okay. Course website, you should have gotten an email, been in the email, is this one. Excuse me. Office hours. Been my practice here. I've been here a little over 5 years now. To not have strict office hours, so I'm just sitting there waiting for you. But I am here almost all the time. If you need to talk, just stop by. Okay, just knock on my door. The worst I'm going to do is say, hey, come back, can you come back in an hour? Okay, my door will be closed. That doesn't mean it's literally closed. No, just knock on the door. It's figuratively open. All right. Prereqs for this class, we'll talk more about that office hours in a second. Prereqs for those guys, hopefully you have it. There is, on the class site already, a prerequisite form, which I think we're pretty close to not needing these anymore, aren't we? Yeah. We'll take them this semester, give you a easy homework grade to get this filled out and submit it to me. The instructions for submission are on the PDF. Right. So we'll look at, so we can look at it right now. Size. So we won't use Moodle. We're going to use this site instead, the one I just flashed up. The address, you should have gotten the email. Resize it all. Their class site, the prerequisite form is linked here. So print your name, sign it, put your ULID, date it, and then follow these instructions to submit it. Okay, due by 5 p.m. next Friday. All right. Everybody got that?
Yes, sir.
Okay, good. You notice there's already a lot of stuff posted on the site. There's more information than probably you need. But I very much feel like my job is to provide you with all the resources you need to learn what I'm trying to help you learn. And I phrase it that way intentionally. Right? It's on you to learn the material. I can't learn it for you. We can't learn it for you. So that means using the resources we provide, asking questions. If you have questions, coming to see us if you have questions. All right? So notice we have information about the three mini projects already posted, some templates. There's a pre-submission checklist for reports. Final contest information will come a little bit later in the semester. Prereq form due date. Lots of example code we're going to get to. We're going to spend about 3 weeks, 4 weeks walking through programming your kit that you're going to buy. Video overview of some of that stuff. There'll be a little bit more video coming up next week, actually. And then a lot of supplemental material to help you out as well. Okay. If you're interested in kind of how things will shake out, there's a Flickr album for each semester. You can take a look at past semesters and projects from those as well. All right. Lectures. I will post these lectures. I'll post my notes. And you notice I'm wearing a lapel mic. I post audio of lectures immediately following lecture as well. So it will be up. You can expect it to be up most times within an hour of the end of lecture. All right. Okay. Also, I'll point out, coming up a little bit later in the presentation, all this code is available on the service called GitHub. So you might want to bookmark this one as well. If you're interested in following along on GitHub, there's a way to get notifications if I change anything there. Just search GitHub Getting Started and you'll get a lot of information. It's a pretty cool system. And then we have an album for this class as well. Not much there so far. And you can check out some pictures from my research. Okay, back to our presentation. So prerequisite forms on that web page. As I mentioned, we have some Flickr photos as well. Here's my contact information. Do have kind of a Twitter account, professional Twitter account, if you will. Feel free to follow. I won't post anything there, only there. Right? If it's something of importance, I will email the class list. All my email communication to you will go to your official ULID associated email address. Okay, so I'm not going to email hotguy@gmail.com or whatever. All right. So look for it there. Again, I'm in Rougeau 225. Again, the door will be closed most times, but I'm here most times too. So just knock if you have questions. Come by and see if you have questions. If you know it's going to be a longer conversation, just email me to set up a time. Like if something you're really not understanding and you anticipate it taking 20 minutes or so, 30 minutes to figure out, probably better to set up a time. Just send me an email. We can do it that way. If it's something quick, just give me a knock. Okay. We also have a lovely instructor helping us out, Ms. Hodge, which I'm guessing most of you guys know already. Most of you know already. Her contact information, I think you probably know where to find her already. Okay. Questions so far? Nothing so far. All right. So the textbook. It's called Introductory Mechanical Design Tools. It's actually by my advisor and an academic professional at Georgia Tech. Especially is actually technical writing. So there's a print version, cost about $35. It is print on demand. Right? So when you order it, that's when they print it and send it to you. About $35. I think the iBooks version is $25. Okay. My feeling is that the reputation of this class is that you don't need the book. I'm going to strongly disagree with that. Okay. There are chapters for everything we talk about in class in this book to supplement what we have from class. Okay. There are chapters that provide example reports that spell out kind of the things we're expecting in the reports from you guys. Right. The iBooks version actually has interactive versions of each of the design tools that we're going to talk about throughout this semester. So I think it is to your benefit to spend the $35 or $25 if you want the iBooks version, dollars to supplement what we're showing you in class. All right. If I didn't think it was worth it, I wouldn't tell you to get it. Okay. So one reason we do, it is, I think, a good value of a book in terms of how much it costs. But that also frees up some of your book budget, I think, to buy a custom kit, right? The core of which is this processor here. So this is actually an ARM processor, same family of processors that's in most smartphones. So, right, allows us to write a code in this language called MicroPython, which we'll learn about. We'll spend, again, about 4 weeks, 4.5 weeks learning that. The total kit is about $120. So you're still out $150 in terms of, that's about what a normal textbook will cost. And cheaper than a lot of textbooks, right? So I think a kit, one that if you hold on to, I think will be very useful when you get to senior design, for example. Right? You can use a lot of the same components, can be useful. There's the link. You should have received the same link from me in an email to the class list. I'll send it out again today. I'll email again after class today. So I'm to remind you guys. So that's the core kit. Each OU will have that kit. It includes this controller, cable, some sensors, servo motor, kind of everything you need to get started working with some robotic stuff. I think it's a lot of fun. All right. You're going to have a final project in here. So to supplement your kit, we actually give you a kit of stuff too. And this is the initial version we have. You've actually added quite a bit since this version. And you're actually adding more this semester. Right. So we'll give each final project team, we'll get a supplemental kit of stuff. It's probably $750 worth of stuff for each team at this point. So I think we supplement and help you guys out in your final project in that respect. So provide basically better motors than you're buying in your kit, better power supply and things like that. Like a pretty cool setup. Okay, so I mentioned kind of this stuff already. We have that GitHub repository, contains a lot of code, a template for the report for you to follow, those kind of things, and also a ton of extra information as well. Okay. Questions? Okay, we'll keep marching then. Schedule. This is up, whole semester schedule, due dates, everything is up right now. So if you want to plan out your semester, when you're going to be busy, those kind of things, it's all right here for you. The PDF version on the webpage also has a Friday. Our assignments, with very little deviation, will be due on Friday at 5 p.m. Okay, all submissions will be electronic. So I don't want any paper from you guys. All right, you'll submit PDFs to me. We'll grade PDFs and send back a PDF to you. All right. Things are due on Fridays. You notice we're going to start our first mini project today. The first mini project, you're going to build something a week from today. All right. So kind of shakes out that way. I have three primary mini projects. And again, we'll spend a few weeks, number of weeks, working on programming. That's the mechatronics kits you see there. And then the essentially whole last part of the class is consumed by the final project and work driving towards it. You'll notice your final contest, which is a big event for the class, which you'll see in just a second, is on the 19th of April. So it's the week before the last week of classes, a Thursday. It's going to be at Blackham Coliseum, again, this semester. And it is actually a National Robotics Week event, again, this spring. So it's been a pretty big event in the past. We do our best to get industry sponsors to come and serve as judges and talk to you guys. Faculty, staff, we're going to have some high schools coming to attending, high school robotics teams coming this semester. So there's that. And then you have a final report and presentation due during exam week. Okay. Questions about that schedule? Okay. So this class actually is derived from one that I served as a TA for at Georgia Tech. So their kind of class, their track's a little bit bigger than the one you're going to compete on. Looks something like that. And what you're going to be building for your final projects are robots that look something like these. Right. We actually have, we don't have quite as much fabrication equipment yet as they do at Georgia Tech, but we're working on it. We have a nice open lab hour space. We'll have somewhere around 15 hours a week of lab time for you to come work on your designs when it gets time to be that, work on those designs. Final contest, you'll have some kind of presentation for folks. And then the robots will actually compete. Notice they have a pneumatic kit there. That's actually one big addition to your kit this semester, a small pneumatic system for you to use. So Georgia Tech right now, they're running 320 students through this class every semester. So it's a little bit different for them. When I was a TA, we were doing 220. A little bit bigger, a little bit more resource intensive than us, but I think exact same class they're getting there for the most part. And the kit that you guys get for your final project is equivalent to the one they're getting there as well. So we're happy to be able to provide that kind of stuff for you. So the first time this was offered here was in spring 2015. The guys on the boat project were part of this contest. We can kind of skip that. Started out 18 students. So. We've grown a lot since then as well. Okay, so in terms of the grading, you're going to have a number of homeworks that are basically pass-fail, for the most part, that you turn it in, get it done, and are in the right ballpark. Make the effort, you're going to be fine on your homework grade. Okay, don't turn stuff in, you're going to get dinged. All right, that's worth 10% of your grade. We're going to have three mini projects. They are equally weighted at 10% of your grade each, based on the reporting and presentation. Then you have your final project that counts for about a little more than half of your grade, but this is the entire last half of the class, including effectively your final exam, which is your final report and presentation. Okay. So you will get some points based on how well your robot does. It's divided among a series of contests. You're going to have two intermediate reports on that final project that are worth about 5% of your grade, and then presentation to some judges of the contest is worth some points as well. And then we have 5% of your grade coming from professionalism. So these are yours to lose, basically. Everyone's got 5 points right now, right? If at the final contest you go off and punch a hole in the wall, which has happened, you're going to get docked some professionalism points. That's not very professional, right? If your team, if you completely abandon your team for the final contest, you're going to get docked professionalism points for that. We'll do team reviews throughout the entire semester. Questions about that breakdown? Okay. We are going to require attendance. Normally I don't. You guys are adults. If you don't want to be here, that's fine with me. However, for this class, we do labs in class, right? And if you're not attending, you're hurting your teammates. So we're going to ask you to attend, and we're going to deduct grades if you're not. So if you miss between 3 and 4 classes, you're going to get docked a whole letter grade. Okay, that sounds like not that many, but if you look at the schedule, a lot of these are kind of open workshop sessions. We'll have things where we're not necessarily counting attendance, but you should be here, basically, is the short answer to that. So 3 to 4 absences is a big chunk of the term, actually, because we're not going to start counting it until sometime 10 days from now, basically. So what happens then if I'm late to class? So our class starts at 3:30. We're going to take attendance at 3:30. The way we're going to do that is you're going to have an assigned seat, actually. And if you're in your assigned seat at 3:30, you're here. If you're not, if you're walking in the door, or you're coming at 3:30 and 15 seconds, you're late. All right. So if you are here after 3:30, by that clock on the wall, but before 3:35, we'll count a half the absence for that. All right. If you come after 3:35, you're effectively absent. Okay. We also do reserve the right to take attendance later in the class. Okay. So don't feel like you can come at 3:30 and get your attendance and then take off, and always be safe doing so. Okay. So come after 3:35, you're absent. Same thing kind of holds for the lab section if you're late for that. And we'll give kind of at most one absence per day. Okay. We'll also round to the lowest integer for grading. So if you have 2.5 absences, you're late, you missed class twice and you're late once, you're safe in that sense. The other thing, if you have an excused absence, you have to submit the documentation for that excused absence within 1 week of the absence. Okay, so don't pile up your excuses and try to hand them to us on the last day of class. It's not going to work. Right. If you don't get it to us within 1 week, then that's going to count as an absence. Everybody clear on that one? It's kind of a little bit of a change. Okay, questions about that? So general rules advice. This first one maybe applies a little bit more to more technical classes, more theory-heavy ones. But we're going to ask you and push you towards being responsible for your own learning. Like I said a few minutes ago, we can't learn stuff for you. We're going to do our job to help you learn. We're going to present the material. We're going to give you resources. We're trying to help you learn the stuff. Okay. Which that means if you have a question about something, ask it. If you don't understand something we're talking about in lecture, come by and see one of us. All right, set up a time to meet, ask the question in lecture if you have a question, and then try to understand, not memorize methods, right? Which that doesn't come up so much in here, right? So be responsible. If you're not understanding the coding or something about when we talk about the coding, come see us, ask questions, okay? We're here to help, okay? The last one is be respectful of yourself and others. We haven't necessarily had an issue with this, but we want to continue that. We do have a class code of conduct that's on the syllabus. So we'll ask all of you to review that. If you have issue with that code of conduct, email me to set up a time to meet. Hopefully I can convince you you're wrong, because I think it's basic human decency that's outlined in that code of conduct. But if you have an issue, we can talk about it. Just set up a time. It's all right. Okay. So that's kind of how the class shakes out for the semester. Questions? Okay. Well, what are we trying to learn? Right? This post-it note was posted on Twitter by one of the senior designers. He's actually kind of interface designer at Facebook. And he's making the distinction between junior designers, or maybe inexperienced designers, and senior designers. Right? And I think this distinction that he's making also holds for design in terms of an engineering design. Right? So if you look at the top, he's kind of saying that, you know, horizontal axis is time in this post-it. Junior designers spend a little bit of time understanding the problem, and then a bunch of time actually designing, and then a little bit of time actually building their design. Okay. So they jump right into actually designing stuff, effectively is what this post-it's showing. Whereas senior designers are spending a lot longer understanding the problem they're trying to solve. What that allows them to do is actually spend less time designing, less time actually building, because you know by understanding the problem correctly what to build, how to build it, what the design should be to best satisfy your customer requirements and your understanding of the problem. Okay? So we're going to stress throughout the entire semester, it is critical to actually understanding the problem you're trying to solve and actually identifying what problem you're trying to solve. Okay? We're going to use the Segway as an example. The Segway is a cool engineering device, but they spent so little time understanding what the customer might want from a device like that, that it's a failure. Segway has lost money every year of its existence. And not a little bit of money, millions of dollars every year. Right? Because they did a super poor job here. Okay? And you're hopefully going to learn from that and do better than that and not lose your company millions of dollars a year by not understanding a problem that you're trying to solve. The other big lesson there is that you could do all this part great, and I maybe could argue the Segway guys did okay there in terms of their design and build, but they're addressing a problem and a set of customer requirements that aren't the real problem. They're solving a problem that didn't exist. Okay, you have the best design in the world, if it's not solving the right problem, it doesn't really matter so much. So that's going to be really the thrust of this class. Working really hard on understanding the problems we're trying to solve. And there's a lot of engineering that goes into just that before we get to picking out what kind of gears and nuts and bolts we need. The other one I like to show in this first lecture is this one. So this guy is actually a graphic novelist. Actually does like middle and high school age style graphic novels, kind of educational stuff. And I thought this was a cool way to think about the creative process. And I find it to be very true for the research my group does anytime you're trying to create something. Right? So basically he's saying, starts out, hey, step one, this process, what I'm working on is going to be awesome. Right? You start moving on. If you're doing something worthwhile, it's very likely it's going to be very hard at some point. And if it's really hard, you're going to start to think, well, this is pretty terrible. What am I doing? Why am I wasting my life on this? Right? And then you may transition into thinking you're terrible as a result of those struggles. Right? And probably in this class, maybe step 4.5 is to say, hey, Dr. Vaughn and Ms. Hodge are terrible. All right? Well, if you keep pushing through that, And if you're working on something on your own and pushing through the I'm terrible phase, I think you get to, hey, to the other side, the light at the end of the tunnel, if you will. And she'll say, hey, that process wasn't so bad. and get to, hopefully, that was actually awesome. So we hope that we're going to encourage you to push through these middle phases in terms of this class and in terms of your design process in this class and afterwards to make it through to that was awesome. Right? Okay. Okay. Time for lab. Everybody ready? Want to stand up, stretch out? We will in just 1 second. Mini project one. You have to design a tower to support a tennis ball as high as possible. Okay, we're going to measure it to the top of the tennis ball. Okay, what's going to make that a little bit hard is that you're going to get 4 ounces of uncooked spaghetti as the building material for your tower. This is 4 ounces of spaghetti. We don't count strands, we measure by weight. So 4 ounces means 4 ounces. I have no idea how many strands of spaghetti that is. This is spaghetti. Not angel hair pasta, not thin spaghetti, not linguine, not tortellini, whatever other kind of pasta you want to think about. It's spaghetti. Okay? It's luxury brand spaghetti. Only the best for you guys. All right? 4 ounces of spaghetti, you're going to get 1 roll of Scotch-style tape, office tape, something like that. I'm going to go buy this today. All right. So your team, when you come a week from today, is going to get a bag of 4 ounces of spaghetti and a roll of tape and a tennis ball. All right? Your tower can only contact a letter-sized piece of paper on your table. Okay. So you're welcome to tape your tower to the piece of paper however you want. The paper has to lay flat on the table, and the paper can't be attached to the table in any way. Okay. So this piece of paper is the base of your tower. Okay. Tower can't tape to the ceiling or the lights or anything like that either. It can only be attached to this piece of paper, nothing else. Can't secure the paper to the table. And you're going to have 45 minutes to build this tower a week from today. Okay. Questions about that so far? Yes? We've done this before, yes. We've been at 4 feet, 4-ish feet. Yep. That high, whatever the diameter of a tennis ball is. I assume you can get that high. Highest tower wins, basically. Other questions? Yes? Our groups will be posted. Groups are posted. We'll talk more about the groups and stuff in just a second. We have a winner. Effectively. Straight up winner. Winner takes all. So I'll answer a few questions that maybe you guys will have in the future, but let's get them out of the way. You can't bring any other tools. So if you're a pocket knife carrier, you can't use that during the build. Okay. We're not going to have scissors or anything else for you. You're going to have the roll of tape, so you can use the little tape teeth to cut your tape. Okay. We're not going to have rulers for you. You can't use rulers. We're going to, basically, this is what you're going to have to build the tower, along with a packet of documentation we're going to talk about in just a second. Okay, so no extra tools. Don't bring super glue and something in a trink. You can try to sneak it. We're going to catch you. Tape, what you have is right there. All right? So between now and next week, your team, and we'll talk about the teams. They're posted, actually went up earlier today. I have a printout. We'll work in just a second. Your team has to design a tower and write instructions to build your tower. Okay? So between now and next week, when you come in this class at 3:30 next week, you have your instructions printed out, and they need to be on this table at 3:30, before 3:30. Okay? If they come after 3:30, you are late. What we're going to do is take your instructions to build your tower and give them to another team. Another team is going to build your tower. you're going to build their tower. Okay? Yes?
This is Thursday, right?
Thursday, week from today. Week from today.
No, not that
part. Okay. That's the whole point of this lab, is you're going to design your tower, and someone else is going to build it. And there's a few reasons for that. One is going to emphasize to you, hopefully, how important technical communication is. But also, it's very much how you're going to work as an engineer. There's very much that you're going to design in your career that you then go down to the machine shop and manufacture a million of yourself. Right. So we're walking down the process of starting to learn how to communicate our designs to other people. This is a huge part of engineering. Okay. There's very, very little in your career that you design and then you're going to walk, or probably nothing if you're working at scale. You're going to walk, you know, going to fly to China to the plant there and work in the plant for, you know, the year making the million of whatever you're making. Or fly to Korea and make a million LG cell phones. Okay. So a big part of the engineering process is technical communication. Yes, sir?
So is the winner the designer or the builder?
The winner is the tallest tower. I'll say that.
Is that a team?
It's a team. So you'll be teams of three people for this contest.
So like one person does the instructions, another person in the group?
No, you do everything as a team. Work as a team to design your tower. Work as a team to write your instructions. Work as a team to build the tower. Well, I think in terms of the winner, you both, whoever built it, whoever designed it, both probably deserve some credit. Other questions about the kind of rules and structure of the actual contest, not grading stuff? Yes?
Are we able to change up?
If you're the build team?
Yeah.
So if you're the build team and you get some instructions and you start working through them and you determine, or you should try to do your best to build the tower as it's designed, as you can glean from the instructions. Okay. If the tower as designed does not stand, then it's at your discretion to modify to make it stable. Right. If you finish the design and have half the spaghetti left over, make sure we're going to get a measurement within the 45 minutes of the height, and you can continue to build to go higher if you want. So you're free once you get the height and try to build as close to the instructions as you can, get a measurement for that, then you can continue to build and try to win effectively. Yes? Yes. So the question was, for the instructions, can we have drawings? I would say, yes, you definitely need drawings. Not just can you have drawings, you should have drawings. Okay? It's going to be really difficult to communicate a design in just words. That's going to be a theme for the rest of the semester. Right? We're engineers, we use figures and tables and plots and stuff, right, to communicate information. So some of the best instructions, if you want to look for what good instructions look like, look at Lego. Right? Lego writes instructions that 3-year-old kids can build, 4-year-old kids can build, right? Other questions about the design process here? You do have to get the measurement within the 45-minute build time. That's another one, right? So it's not build for 45 minutes and then we'll come around and measure. It's during that 45-minute build time you have to get a measurement. You can get a measurement and then keep building. So that's something you can build into your instructions if you so desire, you know. 30 minutes in, you get to this stage of the process, get one measurement, right, and then keep building to try to go higher. Right. So within the 45 minutes, all your measurements have to happen. Okay. Tower. Other questions? And then, following this build process, you're going to report on your design and the results. So your first mini project report will be on this tower design process. So the schedule shakes out like this. Today you're getting your teams and you're going to spend the rest of the time we have available, the next 40 minutes, 50 minutes, working with your team to design your tower. Then between now and next week, you need to write the instructions for the build. Show up with your instructions. Again, they need to be on the front table here before 3:30. To start a class next week. All right. We'll have that tower competition. And then you have the following Friday, the 26th, your report will be due. Okay. There's a PDF on the site already. It's been up for a week now, I guess, with more information and your team assignments. And there'll be teams of 3 students. Should also mention we have some special guests this semester, a team from Korea, some students visiting my lab. Wave hello, guys. So they're going to be designing and building a tower as well. All right. So they're working in my lab for the next 6 weeks or so. So make them feel welcome if you can. Yes?
Are there reports? Like, is it an individual?
Reports are as a team. So all this happens as a team. Yeah. Yes, sir?
Is the team the same
throughout the whole year? Teams will be, so you'll notice, actually I'll flash it up to talk through that. Teams are posted. It's a PDF of the teams. You'll notice that we have names and then a random number. So that random number is a random number generated by a random number generator, right? And that's how I select teams. Every project will have a different team. And I do everything I can to make sure you are on a team with different people. So if I've done my job, you'll work on 4 different teams this term with 4 different sets of people. And we do this intentionally. It's random, because that's in some ways how your work career is going to be. You're going to have, for the most part, have very little choice, very little control over who your coworkers are. So we need to build our skills up for working with people from different cultures, different perspectives, different interests. All right, other questions? Okay, so for the remainder of time today, I'll leave this up. I'll flash it up in a way you can see both pages, but I also have a printout of these guys that I'll put up, 2 printouts actually. 1, 2. So you can come check one of these 2 printouts or look at the PDF, or if you have a phone, I'm sure most of you do, you can check those class webpage, PDF. Find your teammates. Find a place in the class. Work on your design. Do not take off until you've checked with us first. All right? How about it?